Welcome to Discovery 1, Module 8, Part 2. There we go, we can tell I've been on holidays as well. Does anybody have any recollection of what we talked about in Discovery 1, Module 8, Part 1? Anybody remember? This is a bit concerning. Anybody remember what we did in Module 8, Part 1? Yep, we did stuff. That's, very suspicious, very direct of you. Okay, looks like we're reviewing Module 8, very briefly, Part 1. I'd just like to point out at this point that if you don't remember anything from Module 8, Part 1, and you don't remember anything from Module 7 and earlier, you're going to have a lot of fun doing the final, because we do stuff from all of the modules in the final, and we expect you that you know all of the stuff in all the previous modules. If this isn't you, well, you've got 8 weeks to be that person, or to do as well as being that person as you can. Module 8, Part 1, we talked about security, we talked about identity theft, we talked about vishing, we talked about phishing, we talked about obtaining people's phone numbers and credit cards and stealing data and Trojans and all that good stuff, viruses and worms. Ah, yes, it's all coming back to you now that I say it, but yes, that's good. Alrighty, so we talked about phishing, which is where you phone people up and you extract information from them, social engineering, all of that sort of stuff. We talked about vishing, which is the redirection of voice over IP calls to unintended numbers. We talked about the differences between viruses and worms, worms being freestanding programs that were able to infect computers, and viruses being ones that actually attach themselves to other pieces of program code and spread that way, but had to be launched specifically by the user, whereas a worm can launch itself. We also talked about Trojans, which are programs that pretend to be other things that are useful, and then go and trash a hard drive or whatever. Now, did somebody want to say something? We had a mic up there briefly, or not? Well, this is true, and I do remember saying at Lecture 1 that the Cisco course had lots and lots and lots and lots of information in it, but none of you believe me, so what can I do? It's a very complex course, it's a very complex course, it's a very complex course, and I said it a lot. And everybody goes, oh yeah, 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 it'll be fine, and then we get to Module 8 and you're all going, oh dear. Okay, so, viruses, we talked about various antivirus software and various software for getting rid of Trojans and spyware and adware. And we talked about adware being things like Gator.com and various bits of software that install themselves onto your computer and collect information to send it back to advertisers. We didn't recommend any specific software, as we never do, because we're infuriating like that. However, we did make hints on the fact that AVG Antivirus 8.5 wasn't too bad, and that AVG Anti-Spyware was relatively inaccessible with JAWS. We also pointed favourably towards SpyBot Search and Destroy. We told one student that if they were running Antivir, that they would probably have interoperability problems with VMware. However, apart from that, Antivir wasn't a bad bit of antivirus. We had a disagreement on whether Avast was any good. Some people love it, some people hate it. I'm one of the people who doesn't like it particularly much because it gets rid of all my C dollar and D dollar shares, which is probably a good thing to do from a security perspective, but is rather annoying when you're trying to C dollar into a computer and we haven't figured out whether you can re-add the C dollar share in or not, or exactly which dialogue you need to go through in Avast to reactivate the sharing stuff. We talked about the advice that you should always have good backups, and we discussed the fact that most of you may not. We hope most of you do, but the reality is that most people do not have the stuff on their computer adequately backed up on another medium. No, having one copy of your life on a thumb drive does not count, especially when you run the office chair over the thumb drive and that's the end of it. So backups are important. Backup means more than one copy of the data. not all of your favourite books, movies and documents stashed off on an external hard drive that you believe is incredibly safe. We actually had an incident where a friend of mine off one of the mailing lists I'm on knocked their 1 terabyte drive off the desk and it bounced on the floor. Sadly, the 998 gig of books, movies and music on the drive then was unreadable. So be warned. External hard drives aren't as shockproof as you might think. We talked about... What else did we talk about? We talked about all things. We talked about abuse, email abuse and spam. And we talked about the different sorts of spam you could get. Sorry,
I think that's where we got to, roughly, around talking about the email abuse and stuff.
Yeah, I know where we got to. I'm just reminding people of what we actually did talk about last week before the holidays, in case that would do a DRAM refresh on the old brain and part one would come back. If part one doesn't come back, due to me reminding you what we talked about, then there's always a lecture file on www.qcat.org, which you can download at your convenience and listen to at your peril. Okay, we talked about setting up rules in your email program to delete spam, although we pointed out that actually keeping those rules up to date was going to be somewhat of a challenge. We also talked about a potential positive or negative blocking of spam. In fact, legitimate emails could be seen as spam and could turn up in your junk mail folder. I think Grace then reiterated the problem that she had with Gmail, that when you have post your messages to the Cavi Discuss list from a Gmail account, you don't actually see your messages turn up back in your Gmail account. They filter that out for you, which is very kind of them. Apparently the message is from you, therefore you shouldn't need to see it. Do not forward emails that you do not know are legitimate, and we discussed the ones that get sent around about if somebody calls you from insert mobile phone carrier, do not dial *775316#4*6 on your mobile, or it will blow up, kill your dog, shoot your girlfriend and go on a rampage in your local suburb. Why you are dialing that sequence on your mobile phone would be a question I would be asking myself. Perhaps you do have far too much free time, and possibly you shouldn't trust the mobile phone technicians, especially if you don't expect somebody to be calling you up from a phone company. But there are the gullible subset of people that do believe that the message that just turned up in their inbox from Citibank really does apply to them, even if they don't bank with Citibank. So I think we talked about using some common sense and a little bit of sensibility as to what you're going to do. It also is possibly mentioning that maybe there is a new virus called W32.HarddiskSmasher that is going to wipe your computer out the day after tomorrow. Is forwarding this email to everybody in your address book actually going to achieve anything? And will it actually cause people to be more aware of this virus, or will it just increase the hype? That's probably a question you should be asking yourself. You might mean well, but perhaps the other 20 people that have also forwarded this message to your friend have got your friend a little bit upset because your friend now has 21 emails in their inbox about W32.HarddiskSmasher. Anybody got any comments to add about that? Okay, the other thing that is worth mentioning is that they say you should keep your operating system updates up to date, and you should make sure that you have patches installed for various vulnerabilities that you may have on your computer. Although we did discuss the problem with having your automatic update settings set to automatically download and automatically install and don't hassle me. We discussed that there is the occasional Microsoft update, for example, the kill bits for Windows XP, which has been fixed since I spoke of this initially, that caused a whole lot of VB applications to crash nastily because a lot of VB applications were doing something perhaps not recommended by Microsoft, and the kill bits killed off that sort of ActiveX functionality. I think there was a time there when the kill bits update broke JAWS. Did you ever see that behaviour, Scott? Or was that just Mr. Blackburn and his badly configured computer?
No, I've seen it. Not often, but I have seen it. Mind you, I'm having a situation at the moment where JAWS is crashing every 5 minutes and giving me some sort of C++ runtime error, so I don't know. I've reinstalled it about 3 times.
Have you just installed a new version of .NET framework you didn't previously have on your machine? That seems to tickle that bug from what I can tell.
Yeah, I did about a week ago.
Yep, that'll do it. Make sure... I've actually stopped having it with 10.0.512, but I have noticed that once you've installed the .NET framework on your machine and started using applications that use it, that JAWS suddenly starts throwing up Visual C++ 2005 runtime errors, pure virtual function call, and a few other things. And usually that sort of, if you've got Andre Lewis sound scheme involved, that will usually end up with a tick plunk, then about 20 seconds later another tick plunk as the hook loader falls over, and then you relaunch it and it's all good for another 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'm very used to the reboot button now.
Yeah. The other thing apparently that can tickle that bug from what I've been told are versions of... QuickCam. Camera drivers apparently tickle that bug too. So let's hope you don't have a quick cam.
No, I'm not into the webcams.
that's quite understandable. So if anybody else is having that problem with JAWS, there is that problem with certain software and stuff will tickle that bug, and you will get JAWS falling over from time to time. I actually find another way to make that bug repeat itself quite accurately is to leave a command prompt open for 10 minutes. And that will tend to kill it as well. I don't know why, but if you do have a command prompt open, eventually JAWS will decide that it's time that... time that it fell over. That just cut out on me. Okay, back to the lecture. But, yeah, we've seen that one too. Probably worth telling your network administrator if you see any viruses get picked up on your network, because he might want to know about it, especially if the virus came from your thumb drive, which it might have. We talked about the advice of disabling auto run and the auto start logic under Windows, and we decided that thumb drives and auto run were a possible security risk. You did move in here. Good morning, Elise.
Good morning. Sorry I'm late. I got caught up with work issues.
Well, that happens. That happens. And did you solve the problem you had on Skype last night that you messaged me about?
It was about a Bluetooth device, which I can talk to you about off lecture. I think I have solved it, and I don't think I like the way I solved it, but nonetheless, it sounds cruddy, but I'll talk to you about that off lecture rather than wasting everybody's time here, if you like.
I'm sure half the class would actually be interested in Bluetooth devices, but we should probably save it till the end. And yes, Bluetooth devices, if they're designed to work with mobile phones, have a nasty habit of sampling everything down to 8,000 samples per second. Funny that.
Yeah.
Also, the Microsoft Bluetooth stack does not support A2DP, even though it doesn't matter how many times I jump up and down and tell people.
Yes, I was wondering if that was half the problem, and I don't want to install another Bluetooth stack. But I guess that's the way if this conversation's going in the direction I think it is, I'm sure that's what you'll tell me to do.
Quite possibly. Which machine are we running this on? Is this on the big beastie desktop? Or is this
Triple E PC.
Then you will actually find that the Asus Bluetooth stack, which is a rebadged one from Toshiba, is actually quite accessible, and I don't know what you're balking at, but that's just me.
there might be a bunch of configuration options I've not yet found, because yes, you're right, it's quite accessible. I don't mind using it and I don't have a problem. It's just that the headset device doesn't support that whatever it was you mentioned, and it doesn't seem to. Well, the Bluetooth device says it does, and it sounds cruddy and mono and terrible and yucky, particularly on outbound audio.
Well, unless you get a Bluetooth stack that does support A2DP, which the E-Stack does, it will sound cruddy and horrible. So, no escaping that.
Oh, so if the EEE does support it, then I've got to find it somewhere. That's all I need to know, basically, whether it supported it. And if it does, if you think it does, then I'll have to dick around with some more settings to see if I can switch it on, if that makes sense.
Well, you may actually have to find... You have to make sure that your Bluetooth device does support A2DP, but if these are the headphones that you've got from Zaz,
Yes, it's a Philips ones, A2DP, yeah. It says it does. I actually got the manual down off the net last night, and it certainly does.
Well, you might have to find out that. Now, and Grace has materialised. How did you get on the internet? Okay, back to lecture. Right, so we revisited all of that, and it's all good, I think. And anybody who wants to talk about Bluetooth headsets and things, we might do that as part of a Thursday chat one day, because I think there are lots of blind people who like Bluetooth headsets and like wandering around until they walk out of range and all their audio drops out because they went off to make a coffee. Okay... Oh, the other Bluetooth stack that is really good, and you're going to shudder when I say this, is Blue Solial. And it is actually reasonably accessible, but it does cost money, and it doesn't work with everybody's implementation of Bluetooth. So YMMV, limit of one per customer. Okay.
Does it break your computer if you put that on a EEE PC that already has an existing Bluetooth stack?
The manual clearly states that you should uninstall the existing Bluetooth stack before installing Blue Solial. They're very clear about that.
No, that's all right. Well, then I'll put Blue Solial on a PC that doesn't have its own Bluetooth on it, because I actually rather like everything else about the Bluetooth stack that's on the EEE PC, so I wouldn't want to take it away. I'm going to try and get this one working.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Although, as you have discovered, there are some Bluetooth stacks that are crankier than others, and it all depends on the devices and whether they decide they're going to cooperate. Okay. We talked about anti-spam software. We said do not open email attachments from people you do not know, and all of that sort of stuff. Okay, let's get on to the new stuff. We talked about pop-up blockers, I think. At least I remember talking about pop-up blockers. We talked about Internet Explorer's pop-up blocker. And we talked about the toolbars, such as Google toolbar and Yahoo pop-up blocker. And I talked about the fact that when you install certain things like Crap Cleaner and you don't watch the install boxes properly and you're a next finish whoops rabbit that belts their way through install shields without actually reading the dialog boxes, you might end up with a copy of Yahoo toolbar, which will stop your internet banking and a whole lot of other things from working. Joy and fun. Now these days, luckily, Yahoo toolbar has an uninstall option, as does Google. They never used to. Getting them off your system required some rather nasty registry hacking and some file smashing. And we do have a previous student who is quite adept in registry hacking and file smashing. Their machine isn't quite the same as it once was.
We won't mention any names, right?
No, we won't mention any names, but suffice it to say that their computer does not behave quite the same way that everybody else's Windows machine has behaved, because they have actually performed quite a significant amount of degatesing, as they call it, and the machine is never quite the same again. Okay. Now we get into the fun part of lecture. And that fun part is firewalls. Oh, joy. I'm going to protect myself from the world by installing a firewall. I don't even know what a network is, but I must have to have a firewall. Why is it coming up with all of these silly messages? I know, I'll turn them off and just allow everything. Why did I bother installing a firewall after all? Okay, so that's the summary of firewalls. What is a firewall? Technically speaking, a firewall is actually the bit in your car that protects you from the heat of your engine, and in an accident it's supposed to stop the hot engine parts from burning holes in you. It's also a wall that can be erected in a building or something to stop fire spreading. You have firewalls and fire doors that are supposed to stop fire from spreading from one portion of a building to another. As far as the computer is concerned, a firewall is a device that sits between your internal network and the big bad internet or external networks. That's all good. And the firewalls that you can get are sometimes personal firewalls and corporate firewalls. Okay, now, can anybody give me any examples of personal firewalls that you might install under Windows?
Norton Anti-Internet?
Yes, Norton Anti-Internet's a good one. Don't you mean Norton Internet Insecurity?
I'm actually...
That's zone alarms. Anyone use that?
Zone alarm. I'm actually trying AVG, for which I have a license for, and it appears to be working.
Ah, yes, but you have enough vision to be able to use the mouse when it all blows up, which, if you
correct.
Don't,
it's like all
there's bits that you can't get at.
You can't get it with the Jaws curse. And the VET of, what's it called, Computer Associates product is very much like that, which is why I went to AVG, because it's less like that.
And what did you say, Scott? Because you're on netbook mumble mic, so I'm having trouble picking you out.
Sorry. We have the Windows XP and Vista firewall.
There's Zone Alarm. There's another one which was around. I don't know if it's still around. Is that was it called Seagate Personal Firewall or something?
Yeah, we've got bits of you there. Yep. I'm surprised that that's even working. There we go. You actually did manage to get that, the Vista firewall and the Windows XP firewall. We got that. It actually came through in about three different sections. But interestingly enough, the breakups actually came between all the words, so that was kind of cool. Well done.
That was well cued, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was pretty impressed with that. Grace's internet is down because Charter is not at the moment. But that's all good. I don't know how your incoming audio is, how our incoming audio is, Grace, whether you wish to persevere or listen to the recording, but you are here, and we can hear you to a degree. Okay. Righto, cool. That's all right.
I'm about a minute behind you guys, probably.
Interesting. So there's a high round trip time on the cell. Which is interesting. What are you seeing ping times of for you, Elise, on your end at the moment? I'm just making sure our web server's not doing something horrible.
Do you want me to ping the web server?
No. There's a ping time in your Ventrilo window. Can you see that? It's up near the top, or you can Jaws cursor it.
Hang on. Oh, yes. 79. Yeah, about 79. I think I saw it go up to 80, actually.
Ah, now it's showing at 14, so that's not too bad at all.
And then it's dropped down to 73.
And Grace has got a 30-second ping time, which just goes to show you that the round-trip time on the cell nets is all good. 602. Yeah, that's not too bad. Could be worse. That's all right. All right. Well, you'll be a little bit behind us, which is fine, which is good because the US is usually ahead of us in everything else. So we like it when sometimes there's something that's a little bit slower than us that makes us feel good over here in Australia. Okay. All right. Firewalls. I was talking about. We were talking about Zone Alarm, and we were talking about Kaspersky make one. Internet security. It's all right, it's all right. We'll stop winding you up now, I think. We'll leave that to later in lecture. Firewalls limit traffic to and from a network, and there are a few things you can do with firewalls that are quite nifty. One of them is traffic shaping, and one of them is traffic control. And two of those things are very important if you have a teenager in your house that insists on going on BearShare, eMule, Nutella, BitTorrent, Kazaa, Ares Galaxy, or any other of the peer-to-peer file sharing systems that none of us know anything about on this lecture channel. Or if we did, we certainly wouldn't be talking about it. One of the problems with the internet is it's a first-come, first-served system, and if you're hammering your download link or your upload link, for example, it can make it difficult for other traffic that should get through to actually get through. Now, this brings up an interesting point that I keep telling people every year, and nobody believes me. Okay, so I'm going to tell you all again, just in case when this does come up later in your networking career and you think back and you go, that bloke in Australia told me this. The only traffic you have control over is traffic you send. The only traffic you have control over is traffic you send. You have no control over traffic you receive, apart from dropping traffic over and above a specific rate period. You only have control over traffic you send. But that's okay. You know, people don't believe me. So when you're doing traffic shaping and traffic controlling, you have to do it on the outbound interfaces of your firewall, and you have to do it on your network side. Once the packets have been sent by your internet service provider, it's too late. You've already flooded your internet connection. Now, that said, there are ways of actually limiting the speed of TCP connections, which is why applications such as MuTorrent and Ares Galaxy do have bandwidth caps. If you actually limit the number of acknowledgement packets you send, remember I said we can only limit send traffic, it will actually limit the amount of traffic that you receive. However, UDP traffic is not subject to those limits. Now, we don't go into traffic shaping in Discovery 1. Obviously, you can tell it's a topic that I have done significant research on, and I could probably talk on it for quite some time, but I won't. There are certain home routers that provide various levels of traffic control and traffic shaping, and that is usually a subset of the firewall functionality. However, it does have varying degrees of success. Okay, most firewalls limit connections into the internal network with packet filters. And packet filters are things that filter packets. And there are a number of packet filters. One uses a series of rules that says if the packets come from this address, then we drop them, or from this range of ports, we drop them, or if there are this many packets per second, we drop them. Now, there is another form of packet filtering called stateful packet inspection. Anybody ever heard of it? Usually, I've come across it where it says, ABC Company's router provides a spy firewall, NAT, and UPnP forwarding. And you go, yep, that's just clued me up. Stateful packet inspection is where the firewall actually keeps track of which connections are open. And because it keeps track of which connections are open, and it does so because it has to, given that the network address translation machinery requires you to keep a table of active connections, it rejects connections that are not part of an established connection. So if you haven't made a connection out through your firewall, it's not going to let other connections come back in unless you have forwarded ports. Can anybody give me an example of an application that may have a problem with this policy?
VNC?
Well, if you've got a port forwarding, you won't have a problem. The actual application, or the set of applications I was looking for, was VoIP.
Yes, of course.
Hold on.
Hold on.
That's your
side for a sec.
Yep. Okay, so VoIP. It's one of those things that has very interesting port forwarding requirements, and you end up using STUN servers, which is simple traversal of UDP datagrams over networks, to be able to punch holes in your firewall and stuff. Lots of people think that forwarding port 5060 inside their firewall will make their VoIP magically work, but there is a little bit more to it than that. Which is why a lot of these VoIP combination routers have become popular, because what actually happens is the VoIP is embedded in the router, and the VoIP section of the router is actually outside the firewall and connected directly to the internet, which gets rid of all of these port forwarding wobbles. Okay, firewalls often perform network address translation. And we have covered network address translation in previous lectures. Basically, you put a whole lot of private IP addresses behind one public IP address, and you share the public IP address or address pool with the private machines on the inside of the network. Most people have a NAT router, unless, of course, you've got one of those USB things that plugs into your computer that you got free with your broadband connection. The only problem with USB ADSL modems is, if they're the cheap ones, and I'm pointing at the two-wire internet gateway here that usually comes with one of our Pop Telco's internet offerings, is that having your internet running on a USB port will often negatively impact the performance of your whole computer. The other thing people don't realise is that most USB setups on computers usually have two ports per root hub, and if you have a USB 1.1 device on one of the USB ports on the root hub, then that will force the other port on the USB root hub to negotiate down to 1.1, so be aware of that. One of the problems where this can specifically bite you particularly badly is if you've got a USB CD-ROM drive and you hook that onto a port that's also got something USB 1.1 on it. Okay. Now, there are different sorts of firewalls. There is some personal firewalls that are usually designed to protect a single PC. So you install Zone Alarm, or you install Kaspersky Internet Security, or you install the AVG offering, or you install the XP firewall, or you install the Vista firewall, excuse me, or etc., etc., and then you learn how to configure it. And that is, of course, the problem. Most people don't know how to configure the firewall. The Windows firewalls are adequate for simple setups. However, there are a number of problems with various firewalls, and apparently the Windows firewalls used to be vulnerable to these. There is a utility called the Leak Tester. But if I were you, I'd search for Firewall Leak Tester. I wouldn't just search for Leak Tester, or you might end up with some sites that you don't want to visit. So there's one called the Firewall Leak Tester, and it will actually test what information is making it through your firewall and what sort of vulnerabilities your firewall is open to. I thought that was called Shields Up. I don't know whether the Leak Tester is also on GRC, but I think there might be a link to it on GRC. However, don't go running around firing up Shields Up, closing down every port on your network, and then complaining when Skype, MSN, Messenger, and every other thing that you've got on your network suddenly stops working. There are legitimate reasons for incoming connections. It's also worth noting that if you manage to lock down your firewall hard enough to stop Leak Tester from complaining, you will also probably break your VoIP setup, unless it's outside your firewall, because STUN actually relies on some of these vulnerabilities in the firewall, such as hairpin NAT. Okay. Not sure whether theirs is the only firewall leak test, but there's certainly one of them, and there are other ones. The GRC is Gibson Research Corporation, and he's the bloke who wrote SpinRite, and if you've had anything to do with failing hard drives, you may have heard of SpinRite. I actually bought it. Aren't I nice? Yes, but I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people hadn't brought it, and don't own up one way or the other there. But I actually did pay the $60 US or the $89 US or whatever it was, because my data was more important to me than the $89 US. Which brings up an interesting point. Some people are not willing to pay for antivirus software, and they will just use AVG free or Avast free or anything else free. They are then somewhat dismayed when a virus goes tearing through their computer, brings their computer to its knees, and then they wonder why nobody will fix and disinfect their computer for nothing. Sorry, the antivirus software might be free, but the technical support to disinfect your machine isn't. And interestingly enough, once your machine has been trashed by a virus, you may have a bit of problems getting onto the AVG forums, because probably the first thing that will be taken out is your internet browser. I actually do own a copy of the commercial AVG, and when you get infected, you can actually ring them up and they will help you disinfect your machine. Of course,
and
everybody's
financial...
is. Of course, your mileage may vary, and if you don't have any money, then you can't afford any antivirus software, and you'd better make sure you've got good backups. If you don't have money to buy good backup devices, all I can say to you is, I'm terribly sorry, but when your computer blows up, which it inevitably will, the only thing I can do is possibly buy you a drink and say how sorry I am to hear that your data went west. Okay. Which is one of the other interesting points. When I worked for an internet service provider, we told people that under no circumstances did we guarantee the safety or storage of their email. Which did have one of our customers who had 1,450 messages in their POP inbox. When they had those on the server and we decided we hadn't backed up the mail spool for that particular backup run, they lost 1,450 messages, and we said, well, sorry, you should have copies on your computer, and they went, oh no, I just click keep on server and it leaves on your server because I thought it would be safer. Sorry, you thought wrong. Most internet service providers will only provide temporary storage and holding for email. They are not your long-term email solution. Unless, of course, they offer that solution, that service, and usually they offer an IMAP account or similar. Now, this brings up another interesting point, actually, and it's not directly related to the lecture, but people should think about this. You get what you pay for. Who here has a free Gmail account? I do. Okay, but do you trust Gmail to hang on to all of your data indefinitely? I mean, the fact that they've given you 2.5 gig of free storage space, do you trust them to hold on to your data indefinitely? I don't. No. Good. Just as long as we're being realistic about this, you get what you pay for. And in fact, I remember there was an incredible amount of outrage when Hotmail introduced a 60-day or a 30-day inactivity, we delete your account policy. Does anybody know how many days it is for Hotmail? It's not critical to the lecture. I mean, we can find that out. Yeah, I think it's 30. If you don't access your Hotmail account in 30 days, it will shut it down. And a lot of people then said, oh, well, that's not fair, and I will... And I sort of pointed out to them that you could buy a Hotmail Plus account, and if you paid Microsoft some money, which is something that some people are absolutely allergic to, they cannot do that. You cannot pay Microsoft some money. Although, given their success rate, obviously somebody's paying Microsoft some money. Thank you. If you don't pay Microsoft some money, if you pay Microsoft some money, they'll keep your emails around indefinitely, and they'll give you IMAP access, and they'll give you a whole lot of other things. However, Interestingly enough, there is a really good email provider called fastmail.fm, and they have some very cool accounts that provide POP and IMAP and lots of disk storage and stuff like that. Not that I usually advertise these places, but their rates are quite cheap and they're quite good and their service is very fast. However, I'm just pointing out this for people who are on channel here, they do not allow you to do bulk email. They also do not allow you to sign up and use their accounts for people who are doing mass marketing or surveys. So not for everybody. Why? Because the volume of email from those sorts of sites can be quite high, and that will place quite a load on an already cheap server's service, unless you buy their expensive account. Okay, so Gmail's all good, and generally speaking, 99% of the time Gmail works very well, except for when its IMAP servers decide they're going down and you can't get at any of your email. They have been improving that, however. So watch out what you get from a free email provider. All companies do their best, including Gmail and all these other sorts of companies, but you do get what you pay for. Okay, how many people know how to back up their Outlook Express message store? Okay, we've got two yeses.
Yes,
yeah, good. And your Windows address book?
Yeah, do that too. Got a script in
there. Yeah, no, that's all good. Well, we're talking to Mr. Cat here, so, I mean, you've obviously got DD copies of God knows what, so, I mean, you know, that works too. Mrs. Cat, I should say, sorry. My apologies. That's Mrs. Cat.
That's all right, but I tell you what, I did write a script for Linux that will actually pull those, because they're in different directories, and I always find I forget what directories they're in.
Okay, yeah, no, absolutely. Sorry, Scott?
I changed the directories when I installed it, so if Windows goes down, I can still get to the file.
Yes, you can change the directories during the install, although there are some third-party bits of software that expect the address book to live in C, documents and settings, username, application, I should say percent user percent backslash application data backslash local settings backslash Microsoft backslash address book. So beware of that. Also, this is another interesting point that a lot of people don't realise. Without some serious hackery, you cannot store your Outlook message store on a network drive or a removable drive.
No, that would be nice, but it's pretty...
That's still a problem, is it?
Well, the rationale behind it is that if you stored your Outlook Express message store on a removable drive, what if that drive wasn't plugged in when you launched Outlook Express?
Well, you could make it go back to the default, your local message store. I guess it wouldn't be as up-to-date, but... It could be one option.
You could, however, if you were doing that on a POP server and you fetched more messages down, you would then have a UID invalidity problem, so you wouldn't be in sync with your POP server anymore. You would also end up with messages scattered across two message stores, which would be almost very difficult to recombine, and you could also unintentionally cause a complete refetch of an IMAP folder. So, if you're aware of all of those pitfalls, yes, that would be a certain solution. But Microsoft has decided that, no, you can't store your mail on a removable drive. Although Alex is probably going to pipe up here and tell me that there's some portable version of Outlook Express that you can get off portableapps.com or something similar. I certainly know there's a portable Thunderbird. And you can get portable Thunderbird, which can certainly be an option. And once you do the Jaws fiddle to stop it going X-Western in HTML message bodies, Thunderbird is not a bad email client, although it does have some interesting quirks.
How do you find out with Jaws?
It works relatively well. I do know of some people who do use it. As I said, there is the X-Western problem that you've got to get rid of, and I just can't remember how I did that, but there was a blog post I found that turns off some sort of language detection inside of HTML because apparently Thunderbird puts language tags in, which causes the X-Westerns to turn up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's in the configuration manager in text processing.
Ah, yes, I do remember something about that. And there's also a hack that you can put in that allows Firefox 3 to work relatively well with JAWS 7 and up. You edit your file that maps application names to script names, and you add Firefox 3 equals Firefox, and JAWS will load the right scripts. And most of it works quite well, provided you're running Firefox 3.0.5 or later, as we discovered. And you can find out about that by searching for the JAWS and Firefox accessibility page. I'd also like to point out for people at this point that NVDA works extremely well with Firefox 3. Give it a go one day. You might be surprised.
It is good.
Sorry, have you tried that, Elise? Or?
Yes, I tried it the first day I was building this PC before I was game enough to put JAWS back on it. Yes, it works very well. And they're up to 3.0.10, I think. 10 with Firefox, so 9 didn't last a very long time.
There were more security vulnerabilities found in Firefox. I saw a security alert for Ubuntu go out this morning saying that there was a security problem in Firefox and Shoal Runner, interestingly enough.
Yeah, the current version that came in here this morning is 3.0.10. And 9, I think, only hung around for about 2 days.
Yeah, it wasn't, or about a week, actually, I think it was. But, yeah, they have released some more security patches and things. Okie dokie. So, back over here to these notes. Okay, there are a number of sorts of firewalls. You can get integrated firewalls, which are integrated into your router. Now, one of the things that people have discovered about these integrated firewalls is they go and they turn them on and they set the security level to high, and then they wonder why they can't surf the web. You have to be aware of what the firewall is going to do and what traffic it is going to block, and preferably how to add rules for it to allow traffic, because given the number of instant chat and P2P applications, you will need to be opening various ports and things. Another thing to be aware of with router-based firewalls is if you power cycle your router, it will tend to forget its DHCP lease table. Therefore, it will reassign addresses in the order that the machines are powered up. And sometimes some of the badly behaved ones will actually knack an already allocated address and allocate a new one, which will cause all of your port forwards to break. So it's always good if you're going to put a port forward into a specific machine that machine is either reserved in DHCP with a MAC address to IP mapping, or that you statically configure that machine outside the DHCP pool. Can anybody tell me what would happen if you statically assigned a machine inside the DHCP pool? Alright, I'll assume nobody can. If you statically assign an IP address that is already inside the DHCP pool, the DHCP server, if it is a simple one and does not test the availability of the IP address, which a lot of home routers don't, it will actually allocate that address to a PC, and then you'll get two PCs turning up on the one IP address. So, not recommended. The ISC DHCP server actually pings the address to see if it's allocated before it will assign it, although that ping will fail if you have the default Windows XP and Vista firewalls turned on, so be warned. Do we have any questions? I haven't asked yet today. Okay. Personal firewalls are designed to run on a workstation, and they are designed to protect a workstation, not the corporate network, not the internet, not the 6 machines that you've got. A personal firewall is designed to protect a workstation, and they are written with various limitations that mean that you can't do things that you would normally need to do on a server-based firewall. The other thing that is worth mentioning at this point is there are appliance-based firewalls, which are appliances that act purely as firewalls. They basically have a dedicated computer, and the appliance-based firewalls. I was talking about appliance-based firewalls, and then everything went horribly wrong. They're a big box that's basically a dedicated computer with some RAM and some high-speed network switching, and they have multiple Ethernet interfaces or multiple interfaces. And one of the examples of a multiport firewall would be a Cisco PIX, which stands for Packet Internet Exchange. Thank you, Cisco. Exchange starts with an X, does it? And they are quite expensive, and they're quite good, although they do have high-speed packet switching abilities. And then there are other various appliance-based firewalls you can get. You can also get things like the Astaro Linux Gateway, and you can also build your own firewall with packages such as Shorewall, which is the one I use, Shorewall.net, Shorewall.net. And there is also another one called... It runs under FreeBSD, and it's a sort of a web interface-based thing. And I just can't remember what it's called, but it's quite nice. And you basically get a PC with two network cards, and you put your ADSL modem or your internet device into PPPoE, or make sure the public IP address gets assigned to your external interface of your firewall, and then you have the other network cards connected to the internal networks on your computer. Just in case anybody wants to know what I run for a firewall, I run a Fit PC, which is a little PC that runs on 5 watts. With dual network interface cards, a copy of Ubuntu and Shorewall configured up to my specifications. Now, there is inside the firewall, which is supposed to be the protected computers, there is outside the firewall, and there is what we call the demilitarized zone. And the demilitarized zone is where you put computers such as web servers and other servers that actually require you need external access to them. And the demilitarized zone is safer than the outside internet, but it's not as safe as the internal zone. So that's what we also refer to as the DMZ or the DMZ if you live in one of those countries that says Z. I must say, until age 8, I honestly thought it was Z, but that was probably too much Sesame Street. Do not use more than one personal firewall at a time. They will tend to fight with each other. Also, do not use more than one antivirus software at a time unless you are running... Sorry, I missed that. Go down to the bottom of the window. Yeah, okay, right. Yeah, that wasn't worth going back for. Do not use more than one antivirus program at a time unless you've only got them running in demand scan mode. It is possible to use, say, AVG and Norton at the... it is possible to use Norton, but you can actually use them if you've got them in demand scanned only. If you have two resident scanners active, it will slow your computer down quite nastily. Also, with spyware software, make sure that you've only got one set of active protection active at a time, although you can run Spybot Search and Destroy and other similar programs in scan-only mode. And I tend to steer people away from the automatic detection that spyware provides, because it can actually cause more problems than it can solve unless you know what you're doing. Okay. We talked about the demilitarized zone, which will allow users to connect to servers that are inside the firewall. Sometimes you have multiple firewalls, because you have firewalls outside the network that protect certain aspects, then you have firewalls for machines that need to be even more protected, and you can actually have multiple levels of firewall, which allows you to do traffic controlling and policing that you wouldn't be able to do with a single firewall box. So we're talking about bigger installations and things like that. So, That's all good. And I really wish Aaron wouldn't message me in the middle of lecture. Thank you. Thanks, Aaron. Lecturing. Right, that will get rid of him. It's also worth having multiple firewalls if you have high traffic networks, because sometimes you want to pull traffic in at various points, and one firewall will not handle all of the traffic that you're going to shovel into your network. As a side note, has anybody ever seen it when you fire up a copy of MuTorrent? So, for example, you're downloading your Ubuntu 9.04, which would be something that you might be downloading with a torrent network, and the router overflows its connection table and crashes nastily. Yep, that can happen. And you can get around that a number of ways. You can limit the maximum number of connections that MuTorrent opens by setting your maximum connection limit. Or you can put some real firmware on your Linksys WRT54G, such as a real Linux distribution that can handle the multiple connections. If you've got a D-Link or something, there is actually alternate firmware, but you use it at your own risk and you void your warranty. Okay. You could basically go and have a look on openwrt.org and then see if your model is supported, because it might not be. And if it's not, can't help you. There's a wiki that tells you which hardware is supported and which hardware is not, and then you basically learn how to configure the firewall. If you want a GUI-based firewall configuration, you install a firmware called Tomato, which is a fairly useful one that has traffic and all that sort of stuff in it. Okay, now what happens with most home router firewalls is you've got your internal zone and your external zone, and your demilitarized zone is simulated by forwarding all unmatched external traffic to a PC that is inside the firewall. Yes, it's the quickest way to make Warcraft run, but it does open up your machine to every other packet that might be coming in on the internet if you forward all of the unspecified traffic to this box, so you'd better make sure the box is a secure one. Note that on most firewall systems that the wireless network is inside the firewall. Usually it's bridged to the switch, and the switch is bridged to the internal network. So hackers are going to get inside all of your firewall defenses if they get in through your wireless network and play havoc on your network. There are various vulnerability tools that you can use to test your network, such as Shields Up on grc.com. Also, there are tools such as Nessus, I think is another one, and Onagios is a network monitoring utility, but there are some other ones that you can get, and you can actually use those to test your firewall. There's also a utility, I think, called Sherlock, which will go and interrogate machines and tell you what version of operating systems and stuff they're running by looking at the way they respond to various ICMP traffic. I think it's Sherlock. You can actually scan, and you can look for hosts on a network, and you can count how many hosts are running different things and how many hosts have ports open and stuff like that. Usually there are Unix and Linux distributions that will allow you to do penetration testing and stuff. There are versions of the tools for Windows, but we tend to use the ones for Windows and the ones for Linux. The Linux ones tend to be more full-featured. GRML, www.grml.org, which supports software speech, and I've been saying this for the past month, has a whole lot of these tools on it. And you can boot up with GRML and put in GRML space SWSpeak equals eSpeak, and it will come up talking. So if you aren't rich enough or lucky enough to own a hardware speech synthesizer, yes, it's your happy day. And it uses eSpeak. No, it does not use Eloquence. You can make Eloquence work, but you have to pay for it and install it, and I'm not telling anybody how to do it because I haven't been bothered to do it, because eSpeak rocks. Okay, now, the end of summary of this module says, good practice says we should define a security policy. Physically secure servers and network equipment. Yes, that will stop somebody from wandering in through your front door and nicking off with your file server. Set login and file access permissions. Don't give users access to stuff they don't need access to. Update OS and applications. It's pretty self-explanatory. Change permissive default settings. Yes, you can do that to stop things from being allowed by default and stuff. Although, note that if you do set your firewall policies to a default of deny, you then have to go through and allow all legitimate traffic. Run antivirus and anti-spyware software. Pretty important, keep your machine clean and healthy. It's the day that your machine will fall over, die, reboot, and do horrible things that you've got, say, for example, the Cisco final exam or all of your TAFE work due. Yes, you all have your TAFE work backed up, good. Update antivirus software files. There's no point having virus definitions that are out of date, because the newest virus definition will come through and tear your machine apart. Activate browser tools such as pop-up stoppers and anti-phishing stuff. That's probably worthwhile, provided that you know how the pop-up blockers and things work. Interestingly enough, when the information bar in Internet Explorer pops up, which is the... what sound does it make? It makes a bleep sound, I think. Yeah, that's the one.
Did you notice the information bar? Yes, I did.
Yeah. Yes, but some people don't. They don't look up. Look up and live is something like that. Because I've actually got Andre's sound scheme on, and it goes bleep instead of bleep. Okay, so if you get bleep, that's the Internet Explorer pop-up blocker. You press Alt-N to move focus to the information bar. Hey, who didn't know that? Alt-N. None of this stupid JAWS cursoring up near the top of the window. That's just for silly people. Then you press spacebar. And it will actually give you the options to actually allow or deny the pop-up, or always allow or deny the pop-up. So there you go. Alt-N, and then spacebar. Or you can JAWS cursor the information bar if you're really feeling messed. I've never had a problem with it. Maybe there's something wrong with your computer. Is it Vista? Maybe it doesn't always work under Vista. There are lots of things that don't always work under Vista.
Uh-huh.
Or perhaps something else has grabbed your Alt-N keystroke or something. It's very difficult to allocate a hotkey under Windows without somebody else wanting it. I know the developers of the Winamps... Yeah, no, I thought it would, but I've never had a problem with Alt-N, so I think we'd be interested to see why yours didn't work from time to time. And that will put your pop-up blocker up. Also, if you have Yahoo Toolbar installed, its pop-up blocker goes f-tonk. And if you hear f-tonk, that's Yahoo Toolbar, and then you want to go into Add Remove Programs and remove it, unless you've got a specific reason for keeping it around. Apparently, there are useful things you can do with the Yahoo Toolbar, and there are useful things you can do with the Google Toolbar. I just personally haven't needed to do any of those things, so they get uninstalled. Plugin monitors, make sure the plugins that you're installing into your browser are valid and signed, and also use a firewall. That is the end, everybody. Does anybody have any questions or anything they want to talk about? Any general questions about the course? Any general questions about things? We are almost finished. If all goes well, and Grace has some internet, she'll be delivering Module 9 next week, which is all about troubleshooting. That will be quite good. And if her internet doesn't come back, I'll email her a text file of the notes so that she can look through those. And if it doesn't work out, I'll be doing troubleshooting next week, so either way, it's all good. We have then Module 10, which is a sum-up and... and a review of the course content. I will reiterate this, and it won't matter how many times I say it, people will still grimp and grumble. The final test covers material from all 10 modules. So, to be honest with you, you can either go and reread back through all of the Cisco notes before you do your final exam, or you can listen back through all of the lectures. That's why they're up on the web server. No, I am not going through the... No, I'm not going to go through the final exam and make sure I put all of the answers up in handy-dandy bite-sized pieces in the revision lecture so that you can all just sail through the test, because you won't have learnt anything. So, fair warning. Okay, so... We have 8 weeks of discovery left. I am going to try and put some quizzes together, and we'll run some quizzes and we'll see how much people actually know, which will probably be a sad exercise, and then everybody will have to run off and see, and then we'll do the quizzes again.